right, folks. Good afternoon. And my name is Amy, and that was Jerry in the background assisting me, my co-host here at the 4-H Show, because we have a special guest live on the telephone. Megan, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Fantastic. So let me give you a little introduction here. The 4-H Show stands for Health, Happiness, Harmony, and Humor. And for months and months, we have been covering all kinds of amazing subjects. And something that our listeners here in Vermont are a little caught up on is the situation with the masks in the schools, concerns about the kids, and the Agency of Education here in Vermont admitting that they have no evidence masks are safe for children. So I have invited today, we are very honored to have Megan Mansell on the phone with us from Florida. And she, bringing sunshine and fresh air to a subject that badly needs it. And here in Vermont, I think we are ripe for repair around this issue. How are you doing, Megan?
Oh, I'm doing all right. I'm in Florida, you know.
Can't complain.
And I wouldn't want it any other way, especially the way that things keep being brought back. They're kicking a dead horse, especially with in terms of masking and children. So I didn't know if you wanted me to just start talking. Sometimes I can be kind of tangenty, and so I didn't know if you had set questions or. Anyway, sorry.
No, that's fine. No, and it is a little bit just sort of on the fly here with this radio show when I come flying in here. So our listeners are definitely used to us settling in for the first few minutes.
Okay.
So this is perfect, perfect. And let me just read your the biography that I sent out to folks so the folks know why we're interviewing you, why this is critical information from someone who understands the field very well. So Megan Mansell is a former district education director over special populations integration, serving students who are profoundly disabled, immunocompromised, undocumented, autistic, and behaviorally challenged. She also has a background in hazardous environment PPE, that's personal protective equipment applications. She is experienced in writing and monitoring protocol implementation for immunocompromised public sector access under full ADA, that's Americans with Disabilities Act, OSHA regulations, occupational safety regulations, and IDEA, which is, what is that again, IDEA compliance?
It's federal law that regulates kind of what your rights are in an educational setting as a learner with an exceptionality.
Excellent. And see, this is precisely the expertise we need with the condition, the circumstances right now, especially in the schools where they are using special education laws to justify masking students. Megan's going to help us understand why that is just not an accurate use of PPE. It's not even an appropriate modification.
It's also not an appropriate way of accommodating those who serve the children. There are kind of two factors at play here. You have workers who have worker protection rights under OSHA, who you're required to go through and exhaust something called the hierarchy of controls. When you have a new hazard that you've identified within the workplace, you can't just say, okay, everybody wear this thing, and we're going to just call it a day at that. You have to say, okay, is this safe? Is it mitigating? And have we taken the proper precautions to make sure that it is safe on this individual wearer? There are extensive medical clearance and consent arms that have been fully ignored with the masking of employees. But not only that, you've never moved into a circumstance where you're looking at the environment. The environment has to be looked at first, where you're taking environmental mitigation strategies like dilution, destruction, airflow, non-invasive methods that have a really high impact on atmospheric saturation. And I'm talking about atmospheric saturation because this is an airborne pathogen. So every single breath that somebody would take within a given space increases the atmospheric saturation within that space. And so you had kind of this response that people wanted to look like they were doing something. So they just picked something and went with it, even though it was against protocol, even though it was against the worker protection rights we already had in place, and even though every single mask to this day that you have ever seen or put on a child is unregulated, untested, and unsafe with zero efficacy fit, term of wear, or medical clearance standards, every single one. And so on that note, I actually, I asked around of what people were experiencing with their children required to mask, and I wrote a replica study of what children would be experiencing on a daily basis with masking in schools, and had it argued before Institutional Review Board in Arizona by a doctor as a proposed human study. And the practice of child masking cannot pass Institutional Review Board because it is unethical by design. It is you're taking an unregulated apparatus that you don't have any term of wear or medical clearance standards on, and you're putting it on a developing body as a compulsory measure for 8 to 12 hours a day with no health monitoring, no health clearance ahead of time, and total disregard for what a child might pick up on that apparatus through the course of wear. Children drop things and, would have to go and put them back on them. And, children are not notoriously sterile creatures. I'm sure anybody who has young children, as I do, you're pretty familiar with that as fact. And so you're asking a lot of them while, in an operating room, or people who don PPE regularly have extensive donning and doffing training and experience in cross-contamination, as well as 15 pages of medical clearance before ever donning one of these apparatuses in the workplace. And the unfortunate thing 3 years into this is that we still haven't gotten into what works and why. And that's a really important element of it, because our approach was pretty much that we knew that we served medically vulnerable children in schools, and so instead of taking their conditions and their status seriously, as we do with every other accommodation within the public school setting, we just said, we're just going to do this one thing and hope that it works, and totally disregard the physiological or psychological or linguistic or developmental impact that that might have on your child, and that's all we're going to do, instead of saying, okay, we've always done tiered integrated groupings, which are things like self-contained classes or medically vulnerable wings at schools or hospital homebound services, digital academy, things of that nature, which can be temporary or long-term. You're not always going through chemotherapy, but when you are, in order to not fall behind in school but still have educational access, you would have these supports in place that have unfortunately just been completely thrown out the window when COVID came along, because we had these higher agencies assuring us, oh, you're going to be perfectly safe if you just follow this measure, and everybody still got infected. And that's one of the things that I get pretty extensively into. I have a paper called Why N95 Fail to Stop the Spread, and that's looking at the highest grade apparatus, which is actually a bottom of the barrel respirator. N95s aren't great, But looking at an N95 and assuming hypothetical perfect capture capacity at 95% of N95s versus this hazard, I took the output as a per minute or per liter calculations. I did the math on both of them in this article of mine. And I took the output of SARS-CoV-2 versus particle to PFU unit, of the ratio of that, which is of how much matter you output, how much of it is infectious, versus the minimum effective dose of this pathogen. And then applied the 5% to that, which is the remaining 5% never claimed to be captured by an N95 if it's perfectly functioning at 95%. And across the board, basically, you have this apparatus failing to meet mitigation, the mitigation threshold, and you're still exposed to many, many times minimum effective dose, even if properly wearing that apparatus. And the other thing that I get into on a separate article of mine, which is called eye protection was not misdirection. Everybody forgot about your nasolacrimal apparatus, which is why in any direct exposure setting with a hazard, be it a noxious aerosol or if it's infectious material, you're required to don sealed eye protection because your nose, through something called a nasolacrimal duct, your eye drains into the back of your nose. And there have been extensive studies at this point on both RSV and SARS-CoV-2 and SARS-CoV-1 and a whole host of other pathogens on ocular transmission, as well as the infectivity of ocular secretions, which are less likely for others to come into contact with. Your eyes don't emit aerosols the same way that your respiratory system does. However, it has been proven to be a highly infectious route of transmission, and you don't see anyone gobbling it up. And especially for RSV, if you're pushing for masks to be brought back for RSV, ocular transmission has been shown to be a very potent transmission method for RSV.
Let folks know, Megan Mansell's writing can be found at the Brownstone Institute. I think some of the articles you're referencing right now. And she's also written a book called Accommodating Chaos, Correcting Course on a Plague of Misinformation. And a lot of what she's covering with us today is in this great little book that I really recommend everyone get a copy of. And I know you were going to make that really available for folks, Megan. And in this book, she has these great pictures of these masks and the plumes, you know, of course, that come out. And one of the plumes goes right up to the eyes, and that's why the glasses fog. I think you point that out in the book.
Yes.
And so that masks can actually increase.
My pandemic work was all found on rational ground, and then my more recent work is found on Brownstone Institute. And the article from Brownstone Institute that goes into minimum effective dose and all of that is found in my mini book as an addendum. It's on Amazon. I have it published at the cheapest possible range that you can, both for paperback and for Kindle. I also offer it pro bono for educational and professional development purposes because my aim was never to, you know, profit off of a crisis. I've always felt that, you know, when you have people who need proper information, who are just trying to protect one another, that's not the time to worry about, you know, profiting off of that. So if anybody needs to reach out and wants this as a professional development tool or consulting for your school or for your workplace, you can reach me at accommodatingchaos@gmail.com. It's also the name of the book. And I get into things like tiered integrated groupings, as well as each individual mask type, as well as that you that you commonly see people wearing. In addition to the very erroneous concept of source control, masks are not source control for aerosols.
So the whole idea of you're protecting others, right, is totally untrue. And you helped explain that to me. It's the exhale. Da-da! I never even thought about that before in all the years I've been studying masks. The exhale just makes even an N95 ineffective completely for others.
Exactly. And I show valved and unvalved N95 respiratory emissions. And that's one of the things that people still don't understand to this day. And that's one of the reasons that I wrote that article on N95. Perfectly capturing 95%. And that's for inhale. There's no claims whatsoever that can be made about the ability of an apparatus to be assigned a given percentage of efficacy as source control. And that's something really extensively covered in ASTM standards, which is the American Society for Testing and Materials. I was going to bring that up here, but I was trying to find my screenshot of it. But basically, you the more fitted an apparatus is that you're wearing, the greater the pressure behind your respiratory emissions. So if you have on a loose-fitting apparatus, it may go through the membrane or more likely around it. Aerosols take the path of least resistance just as any fluid would. But just like if you had your garden hose on a mist setting, you have a droplet or a large particulate with pressure on it against a membrane, and that can take what otherwise would have just settled in a predictable arc and force it into smaller and smaller matter that can remain aloft for hours. The notes that I was going to communicate were the American Society for Testing and Materials Standard Specification for Barrier Face Coverings, F3502-21 Note 2. There are currently no established methods for measuring outward leakage from a barrier face covering, medical mask, or respirator. Nothing in the standard addresses or implies a quantitative assessment of outward leakage, and no claims can be made about the degree to which a barrier face covering reduces emissions of human-generated particles. As well as Note 5, there are currently no specific accepted techniques that are available to measure outward leakage from a barrier face covering or other products. Thus, no claim may be made with respect to the degree of source control offered by the barrier face covering based on a leakage assessment.
Yes, and this ASTM, folks, if you're looking for the link, go to the CDC's website. That's my favorite place to find it. Right on their page about the types of masks, they send you to that AS. That's how I found it. And then when I heard Megan talking about it, I said, wow, this is true. I'm reading this correctly. The oversight group that the CDC depends on has found and has always said and never ever said anything different and has puts this right at the top of their website. They want you to know this, that these masks, even respirators, which are N95s and dust masks, they have absolutely no way of measuring whether they're effective at all at protecting others. So that is the big myth. That's a huge one right there, because that's...
It's a huge myth. And people haven't, you know, dug that far into it. And what I was going to say is that ASTM F3502-21, I would Google that with the word PDF behind it, because otherwise it's a $64 document. but if you Google it as a PDF, it is readily available from some people out there who have provided that as a resource. So, and you can read Note 2 without having access to the full document from the CDC website, but not Note 5. And there are some other helpful ASTM standards out there, like ASTM F3502-21 Section 3.1.7, defining a medical face mask as an item of protective clothing designed to protect portions of the wearer's face, including the mucous membrane, areas of the wearer's nose and mouth, from contact with blood and other bodily fluids during medical procedures. Nothing within that definition Will you find anything on the protection of others? Because this is about aerosols, and again, they make no claims of the protective capacity of these to function as protective of aerosols. So if you have somebody saying, oh, well, what if it's only 10%? Okay, then you need to look at atmospheric saturation with output as a constant and try to see, you know, I've provided the calculations of an infected individual and the full spectrum of transmissibility that's available in current research. But if you had someone who was highly contagious and very ill, what it would look like, what their degree of output would look like. And these apparatuses, the CDC's own publications found surgical masks and cloth masks to be 80 to 90% particle penetration for these. So, you know, you're looking at, and that was looking at kind of larger matter than you would be for respiratory emissions anyway. Basically, all of their particle size ranges are off by a bit, which is why you'll also see people trying to discuss minimum penetrating particle size. But there are some pretty good papers on how even the NIOSH assessments don't actually accurately calculate most penetrating particle size because they're using salt particulate and sensors only for measuring salt particulate far larger than the particle size range of emitted matter as respiratory aerosols. So, and there's another here, claims for the approval for children. NIOSH does not approve any type of respiratory protection for children. That's directly off their CDC website.
Yeah, so NIOSH is the CDC's wing, right, that for worker protection?
NIOSH is an oversight, and they use it directly for any guidance on their. And then you also have SIDRAP, which is another agency that they kind of look to for things. But, you know, this is clear. It is out there. It is readily available. That, you know, it also says something that we had a full 8 or 9 months into the pandemic. We clearly had airborne spread because people were getting sick in different parts of a building with no contact with one another while on a shared HVAC system. And the only explanation for the possibility of transmission would be airborne pathogen. But you never had a public pivot as it should have been that, you know, we were pushed distancing. We were pushed we had hand sanitizer pushed on us. And all of these things were mitigating only for droplet, not for aerosol. And nobody came out and said, okay, everything that you've been told to do is false. An aerosol unbound trajectory with no pressure influence on it, just general respiration, has an 18 to 20 foot trajectory. So no amount of distancing that you're doing in a space is going to be helpful. And this is matter that remains viable in an enclosed space and saturates with every single breath. The atmospheric saturation increases with every single breath that a transmissible individual is within a space. And it takes very, very little of it to get sick. And one of the things that I provided in my work is the full spectrum from current research of all claims of minimum effective dose. And it goes as high as 363 plaque-forming units and as low as 1. Just, you know, I provided everything that was out there. But the established particle to the established PFU required for transmission of SARS-CoV-1 was only 13 PFU. So we're dealing with something that it probably isn't a lot of viable matter required in order to get sick. And if you're not very sick, or if you're in the recovery stages, your level of output of emitted matter is a fraction of your output during high course of infection. So the more than 90% of the matter emitted when you're highly contagious, very infected, very ill, are under 0.3 microns, which nothing you see anybody wearing is even designed or approved to capture. But if we assume that it was perfectly capturing all of that, at that 95%, it still fails because it's such a high output pathogen during the course of transmission. But when you're not very ill and when you're in recovery stages, your output of matter is reduced so much that if you look at the figures, it really kind of serves to kill that concept of asymptomatic spread. Now, and I feel like people are kind of confused on what asymptomatic is. It's saying that you're entirely not ill at all, not exhibiting any symptoms of illness. But we also have to think that there are some people who haven't been defined as asymptomatic in 10 years or more. You think of people with COPD or other, you know, chronic respiratory illnesses who are kind of hacking around all the time. So there's never a big difference between what they are normally or what you would define as asymptomatic for these individuals. And so then you're kind of looking at, well, who's most likely to be very severely impacted by this? And the mortality rate for this pathogen is higher than the is an older age than the average mortality age within the U.S. I think and it's not funny for those people impacted, but I believe that the infection fatality average age for the vast majority was 82 years old. And so you're looking, and I believe that the overall U.S. mortality average age was 79. So you're looking at, for this pathogen, an older age than people, that then is standard for people to pass away within this country. And I think of the impact we could have had on that number if we were truthful and precise in our response, if we just took the time to pivot when a pivot was needed and correct course when that was necessary.
Right, and which is why we need to have, you know, the right people at the table and listen to the right people. I want to remind listeners that we have Megan Mansell on the phone with us right now. She is a former district education director over special populations integration, serving students who are profoundly disabled, immunocompromised, and with other challenges. She has also a background in hazardous environments PPE applications, and with public sector access under laws like ADA, OSHA standards, and IDEA compliance. She is one of the multidisciplinary experts from the Frontline Doctors Industrial Hygiene and Multidisciplinary Support Summit, which I do encourage people to find, I link to them on my website so that you can watch those videos. This was a very important support summit that happened last fall that many people don't know about, where they actually gathered these OSHA experts like Megan, like Tammy Clark, like Kristen, Megan Kelly, like Dr. Christina Parks. And it is really important that we listen to these experts, because physicians are not PPE experts. Doctors are not PPE experts. School board members and superintendents and even school nurses are not PPE experts. And we've been listening to folks who actually don't understand how PPE works. And by telling vulnerable people that you'll be safe if you wear a mask, you know, that could be extremely dangerous if those masks are actually not protecting them, because now they may be taking risks, right? So the whole first half of this show, we've been talking about the effectiveness of masks. And in a moment, it would be a great transition to go into, okay, so if they're not effective, but even if they were, you know, what are the harms? Are they dangerous? And nobody's been told that. And I want to let folks know this is a very exciting time here in Vermont, because we are bringing Megan's expertise along with those other experts I mentioned to Vermont. We are having a forum in May. Save the date, May 12th, the day after the emergency ends. It's time to end these emergency use authorized products such as masks and have a full assessment of the harms, which is why we are holding the Vermont Emergency Forum to assess the respiratory hazards of masks in Burlington, literally in City Hall. City Hall Burlington on Church Street opens out on the park and everything on May 12th. Please join us if you're an employer, an employee, if you're a student, if you're a teacher, if you're a parent, whoever you are, a medically challenged person who has been suffering with these masks or is concerned about these masks. Let's really talk about it and bring fresh air. So thank you, Megan. Yes, I'll let you continue. Thank you for letting me give us a half hour kind of update on what we're doing here today.
But you brought up a really good point, which was about doctors and nurses. They're consumers of a product. They are required to meet annually for fit-tested hazard-specific kits for each workplace exposure scenario with an industrial hygienist, who is the one who performs the fit testing and prescribes each apparatus specific to that person. So when you saw, your druggist or your hardware store putting just piles of N95s on a table, that even if those apparatuses were mitigating, there are many sizes of these. We don't all have the same face. We don't all have the same respiratory system. So you can't say that an apparatus deemed safe for me for X term of wear is transferable to any other person, both based both on the size and individual health status. And, you know, when you have individuals within a given nosocomial setting, there's already an exposure rate of 40% to a given pathogen within that ward. And so, you know, if you're not actually doing anything to address that, it's a medical issue once you get sick. That is why I believe that things were conflated to this degree, because, you know, you get sick, you see doctors wearing a mask, so you think, well, those are the people that you would ask about that. And then we have people like Jerome Adams, who was the Surgeon General at the time, showing people how to make T-shirt masks. If you wouldn't wear this apparatus for a gas leak going on in your house, you should not wear this for an airborne pathogen.
Ooh, let's repeat that. That's a really good point.
If you would not don an apparatus for a gas leak in your house, you would not don it for an airborne pathogen. And what would you do if you had a gas leak? Let's think about that. You would increase airflow. You would open your dampers. You would get out of the house until the hazard had been removed. You would open windows. You would, try at all costs to avoid that hazard, because you know that with a gas leak, you have that saturating your given space, and it's very dangerous. The longer it's able to go for, the more atmospheric saturation you would have of something you can't see. You can smell it with a gas leak, but that's not the case with an airborne pathogen, but you need to treat it just the same.
Great. Yeah. And so these there are these vaccine or mask mandates. A lot of folks think, you know, the masks are over. Let's just walk away from this, because it was, you know, very intense and traumatic and difficult physically for people to wear them. People are so thankful, you know, that maybe it's over with. Thank goodness. But there are these vaccine or mask mandates, which are still in existence in medical facilities. And OSHA currently has guidance for other employers, encouraging other employers in all sectors to implement vaccine or mask policies, which means either you stay up to date on the vaccines that your employer warrants you need, or you have to wear one of these non-mitigating masks. And we also have the schools, which are imposing them on kids. So it is still continuing to happen. And yet at the same time, OSHA also has a standard in place which says that even if N95 type respirators are going to be worn voluntarily in the workplace, the employer is still responsible for assessing the hazards. So how can employers be responsible and teachers and superintendents and school managers and medical facility managers all be responsible in the supervision of this device, of managing this hazard? And what do they need to know about the hazards of masks before they even consider using them?
The detrimental effects are known, anticipated, and absolutely part of the respiratory protection requirements under OSHA. And what you were speaking of regarding the vaccine mandates or mask mandates, when those OSHA policies have been challenged or part of public speaking forums where public input was allowed as part of the rulemaking process, they failed every single time.
How come?
But when it has been challenged, when it's been challenged in California, when it's been challenged in New York, when it's been challenged for U.S. policy, and some of the people who spoke at the America's Frontline Support Summit that you were referring to, also, you know, I spoke at those, but they did as well and gave input that we're following false policies. We're trying to look like we're doing something, but nobody seems to know what to do. So they're just picking something and disregarding the harms. And you don't know specifically how a harm is going to manifest for a given person. And one of the examples that I would give here is all of the people claiming that they have long COVID. Now, there are post-viral syndromes for every other pathogen out there. I'm by no means saying that nobody has any kind of post-viral symptom or condition, but the manifestations of long-term hypercapnia and hypoxia from donning these highly restrictive apparatuses that absolutely restrict breathing and long-term use of those have the same physiological manifestations as what you see people complaining of when saying that they have long COVID. There is, and a lot of the same physiological manifestations are VAERS reported from the vaccination of what people are experiencing as symptoms. And so there's currently no available research that excludes both long-term mask or respirator use and vaccine status in any of the long COVID studies. And so I think that it's definitely something that people need to be considering as a factor in what they're experiencing. And if you had it and you were wearing this apparatus and you're continuing to wear the apparatus afterwards, well, for one thing, you also have antibodies already, and the robust antibodies from having recovered from this pathogen have been demonstrated pretty consistently to be better than that received from the vaccination. However, it's also a little backwards to keep wearing something to protect you from something that you've already had. We also had something with this pathogen that I've never seen come up before, which is how many times did you run out and after having a given pathogen, okay, you had flu this year, how many of you then went and got a flu shot? We saw that all over the place with COVID, of going and getting a vaccination for something you already had and recovered from. And that's never been a commonplace thing to do before, and kind of an odd thing. And so when it comes to children within school systems, there are many, many different ways that these apparatuses, the by wearing masks or respirators could be harmful to these children. You have a requirement to see tooth, tongue, and lip placement for linguistic onset and development. And that's of your caregivers, of your peers. One of the articles that I've written for Brownstone was a child's life on mute, which was helping a family to kind of guide them on how to seek better accommodations for their child who was hearing impaired, profoundly hearing impaired. And all of his caregivers and all of his peers were masked all day. Nobody spoke sign language. And his only other method of communication was lip reading. He spoke sign language and he lip read. Well, he couldn't see anybody's face. And nobody knew sign language. So he was regressing and having behavioral issues. Well, of course, his entire world was just putting him aside and him having to be compliant with this thing that wasn't even helping to begin with, but all for the appearance, all for appearing like it has absolutely been safety theater. And so we were thankfully able to get him proper accommodations very quickly. And so he was able to then see peer and caregiver faces pretty quickly after the fact. But, you know, the hard of hearing and the community of people who are hard of hearing and deaf have definitely been just kind of set on the back burner for 3 years while society just kind of decided that they weren't part of this response and that we didn't need to, you know, kind of think things through on what kind of an impact this would have on people for a pathogen with a 99.8% survivability rate. And I say that because if you're here, you're listening to this, you're part of the 99.8% who were likely exposed within that time period and survived. And there's a 0.2% of the population. While that's a really small number, on a wide scale basis, that's a lot of people. That's a lot of individuals who thought they were safe following the measures that were recommended to us, and they died. They died because, and how many of those people died with an absolute false sense of security that they did everything they were told to do, and yet here we are. And so we didn't take their lives seriously. We looked at that as a small number, and that flippancy has been added in to our response. If you knew that the room down the hall from you had aerosolized cyanide, you know, you had cyanide gas in that room, where if you walked in that room and you were exposed to a certain amount of it, you would die. You wouldn't be flippant. You would, you know, if you had to go in that room for some reason, you would absolutely, you know, check all of your boxes on making sure that you were wearing an apparatus that would protect you 100% from that hazard. But we factored in that 99.8% survivability rate to our response and gotten this absolute flippancy instead. And for the 0.2% of the population who can't survive it, they might as well be going into a room with aerosolized cyanide or any other noxious agent in there, because exposure does equal death for those individuals. And then we could get into the whole from versus with part. But I don't know if many years down the road we're going to have hashed out, you know, the froms versus the widths. As nice as it would be to know how many, you know, obviously if it's a gunshot wound or a motorcycle accident, that was not an actual COVID death, which we've seen on many, many cases where things were miscategorized. But if you have a ventilator death, or you have people who had 5 comorbidities and it's the unfortunate circumstance where somebody said, hey, John passed away, and you're like, well, that sounds about right. Well, what from? It could have been stubbing his toe. You know, those people who, you know, you love them, but they just didn't take care of themselves, and no given day of the week finding out that they passed away would have been a surprise to you. That's a large portion of that 0.2% of the population. And people don't want to admit that they're part of that population. People either have a touch of hypochondria, where they think they're part of that population when they aren't, or they're part of the population of people who free will and personal risk mitigation includes, you know, there's an example that was valid for a while, and it's not now, thankfully, but for a good period of time, you could ride a tiger through a flaming hoop, buck naked, smoking a joint off a cliff in California, as long as you were wearing a mask. And, you know, we had just absolutely ridiculous things like that pop up, where it's clearly not about safety. It's not about personal risk mitigation. At that point, it's about compliance. And we're not intervening on all of these other parts of life, where people engage in risky behaviors every single day. They do stupid things every single day, but we've never tried to just control every aspect of their life in the name of safety before. And we do have some safety measures in place for public good, but when an apparatus does not protect other people from what you may be carrying, and instead instills a false sense of security for other people that, oh, well, he's sick, but he's wearing a mask, so we're all fine.
Right.
How many of you would just be like, hey, I'm going to wait in my car until it's my turn at the doctor's office instead of sitting in the waiting room? Little practices like that. Okay, well, how many of you would be seen in drive-up doctor's offices for swabbing and things of that nature, instead of going and sitting among transmissible individuals when there's nothing wrong with you, when you're perfectly fine and you have to go have this test done as a condition of your employment? And one of the other things I saw very early on was our test site administrators in non-mitigating apparatuses, the person most likely in contact with this novel pathogen, because everybody else is home. So you've got the person most likely in contact with a novel pathogen in a non-mitigating apparatus, and most of them at that time, or many of them at that time, were wearing valved respirators, which have a focused emission plume right in the front of their mouth. So
right.
You have them breathing that directly over your testing materials, directly in your car window. So, you know, we're looking, and then they take those materials and stick them right up your nose. So, you know, to see it from my perspective, it was just absolute insanity. It was the most backwards response we possibly could have had. And I think that these practices are very much responsible for how bad things got. So, you know, I don't even like to sit around and dwell on how many of these deaths were preventable just based on the false sense of security that basically everybody bought into.
Right. So. And a severe dose of censorship and shaming people who questioned it. I was actually at a school board meeting where a parent asked that question. You know, they were doing all this testing at the school. Well, what type of safety apparatus is the tester person wearing? You know, and they asked about that, got no answer, of course, because, you know, our superintendent doesn't know how to answer that question. He doesn't even know that that's a thing. And so I was wondering, you have a great explanation of the peanut allergy analogy, because that is one we hear at these school board meetings a lot, that we're just protecting kids with masks the way we would protect kids with peanut allergies. So why is that like a false allegory?
If I take a whole school and I say you are completely banned forever from having peanuts with, you know, bringing them to school. Everybody comply with this starting now. Someone's great-grandma is going to be babysitting and pack lunch the next day and say, well, I'm going to make a nice peanut butter and jelly sandwich for you, and you're going to enjoy it. And the little kindergartner's not going to say, well, our school has a peanut allergy. And then you get to stab an EpiPen into the the peanut allergy kid's leg on the playground while you wait for the ambulance to show up, because there's no name attached to it, and there's no buy-in, and there's no consensus part of it. Or you structure a class and you say, you know, we have this one child in third grade who has a very severe peanut allergy. Could anybody commit to, you know, we're not saying you can never eat peanuts again, but if your kid's really not all that into it to begin with, it's not a kid who will only eat peanuts, which, you know, there are kids out there who are super picky and they don't want alternate nut butters. So if you're willing to be part of this class, can you let us know if you can wash your hands, brush your teeth, and maybe change your shirt before coming to school if you've had peanuts, and just commit to never, ever bringing it to school? And then that class eats in their classroom, and you have a fully supported and accommodated child without having to, you know, rely on mass communication with something that could kill somebody. And so that's what tiered integrated groupings are. That's, you have an identified need, and you structure how best to accommodate that given learner based on the resources you have available. And a lot of it's just being, you know, the application of logic. It doesn't require a lot more than that.
Yeah, and the compliance piece being such a big part of it. A lot of the studies I came across when I was researching masks and their history of use in medical settings was that how many studies were based on compliance. That's all they were really looking at, and how difficult it was to even get surgeons in surgery type settings to take their mask hygiene seriously and to, you know, to follow the rules.
I want to touch on that because there's two, I get into conversations like this with people all the time. And so there's two main things that they will say, that the Canadian randomized control trial, that people were only compliant for 80% of the time max. Okay, well, that's because a fitted respirator cannot be worn for the duration of an 8-hour shift, or a 12-hour shift, I'm sorry. You have these long shifts that absolutely, by their terms of wear and your medical clearance for this given apparatus, it can't be worn for the duration of the shift. And then you have the Bangladesh study, which took impoverished, resourceless individuals who had no other option, you know, no other PPE available to them. And you had this pushed on them under police presence by, you know, their local police went around door to door with these researchers, which was part of the preprint, but interestingly enough, they removed from the print copy of that Bangladesh study. And I think that says a lot. There were also financial incentives for compliance with this. And so you kind of have the two different parts of that. And that was on surgical masking. And so, according to their results, if you wore a purple surgical mask and you were of a certain age cohort, then and only then would it work for you, which was nonsensical to begin with, but it was such an unethical study that I do have to drop off in about 5 minutes, so I wanted to just get that heads up.
Yeah, thank
but,
you.
It was really just... It has been a really backwards response. And if anybody ever has one that they say, oh, well, I think that this is a really good mask study, I'll read it. And most of the time I have people not even understanding that what they're sharing is a model from 2020.
Right.
Or, so much of it has been based on modeling and not on reality, not on actual studies involving humans. So, you know, that definitely matters.
Right. And that's why there are no studies showing that masks are safe, especially for children, because it would be unethical. And we are speaking with Megan Mansell, who proved this. I thought that was just brilliant when I heard you explain, which you do in that Brownstone article as well, how you asked a review board, not you, but a representative for you, presented your study, which was based on how they mask kids in schools right now, you know, with no medical clearance, with no supervision, without apparatus, without even telling the kids, you know, tell us if you're having trouble breathing, honey. You know, I mean, there are no safety protections at all. And of course, the ethics committee, was it in Arizona, I think, denied it.
Yes.
Just outright.
Yes. This breaks. Unanimously rejected on anticipation of harm and ethical withholding.
It breaks the first rule.
And I encourage anybody else to have that argue before their IRB as well. You have some local vocal pediatrician who's saying, well, I think that your children should be wearing this. Okay, I want you to go argue this among your peers, and I want you to lay out the details of it as a proposed human study, exactly what you're asking children to be compliant with. And I'd also like to say there are no mask breaks or PPE breaks in actual exposure settings. So we, you know, there are all of these things. Well, we gave them a break every hour for 5 minutes. Okay, well, for one thing, this is such a high-output pathogen that if there were a transmissible individual within that space and such a low minimum effective dose for this pathogen, that they absolutely would have been exposed within that break period, but they're going to be anyway because it's a non-mitigating apparatus. But also, you don't take a break just because it's uncomfortable when you're in actual direct exposure to a hazard requiring respiratory protection. So that is pretty important.
It's super important. And how did you find the courage, Megan, to keep speaking this truth despite what others say?
There has been a toll. I'm not gonna lie about that. It's been pretty hard, and I've had a lot of hate from it, and it's kind of, you know, developed a thick skin, but, you know, it's, you do what's right when there's a time that is your time to speak up, and I felt like this was, I didn't see anybody else going out and saying the things that I felt needed to be said, so that's, I, you know, put myself in that position. Hey, stop knocking on the door. Sorry.
Our time is up.
My three-year-old wants in this room. So.
Of course.
My husband is home. He's not out there by himself. But on that note, I do actually need to get heading out because my husband came home on his lunch break to...
Yes.
Let me get to speak with you guys today.
Oh, thank you so much, Megan. Yes, we'll let you drop off the call, and I will tell people where they can find more of your information. Thank you, Megan, and I look forward
to
talking more with
me.
You and having you speak at our summit, at our forum in May. Thank you.
Looking forward to it, and please don't hesitate to reach out, even if you think that you're going to be bothersome or whatever. Please, my email again is accommodatingchaos@gmail.com, and I will reply if you reach out. I enjoy hearing from people, and if you have something that you need help with, I will try my best to help you or put you in touch with someone who can. Okay.
Oh, you are heaven sent, Megan. Thank you so much. Have a great day with your kids.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye bye. All right, folks. So we were honored here this past hour to be joined by Megan Mansell, a former district education director over special populations integration. Megan Mansell's writing can also be found at Rational Ground, at the Brownstone Institute, And also, she is going to be one of the presenters at our Vermont Emergency Forum to assess the respiratory hazards of masks, which is happening in Burlington, Vermont, at City Hall on May 12th. You can find the Save the Date, and pretty soon you're going to see registration information at vtmasksurvey.com. So please go online if you want to find out more about Megan or about this forum that we are having in Burlington. Go to vtmasksurvey.com. And if you ever want to share previous episodes of the 4-H show, you can also find our library. Our collection of 4-H shows previously aired is also available at vtmasksurvey.com.